Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by Vladimir Putin that he will release his most prominent political prisoner, as well as two of the members of the punk rock group Pussy Riot. Nina Kusheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School, joins us to discuss Putin's apparent confidence that he can appear magnanimous, having got his way in Syria, Ukraine, and at home, where he has eradicated all opposition and extinguished politics in Russia, ahead of hosting his showcase Winter Olympic Games in Sochi. Then we'll speak with Lako Tongan, who is a professor of international and intercultural studies and political studies at Pitzer College. He is from South Sudan, and we'll discuss the leadership struggle between President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, Riek Machar, that threatens to break out into a civil war as army mutineers take a key town. We'll get an analysis of the reasons behind the fratricide in the world's newest country and one of its poorest, that has been at war with its northern neighbor and now appears poised to go to war against itself. Then finally, we will speak with Wallace Turberville, who is a senior fellow at Demos and previously an investment banker at Goldman Sachs, who has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate and the House Financial Services Committee. He's the author of a new report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy, and we will discuss this unnecessary bankruptcy imposed on the Democratic City by a partisan Republican governor, and the latest ruling by the federal bankruptcy judge criticizing the priority of paying back Wall Street banks 82 cents on the dollar while offering police, fire, and city pensioners 16 cents on the dollar. And joining us now is Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She is currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kusheva.
Thank you.
And it does appear after President Putin's press conference on Thursday, where at the end of it he made a kind of offhand remark that he was freeing the oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, that caught everybody by surprise. Are you surprised by that move?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I would have said he probably wouldn't pardon him, because until very recently there was all this conversation of how dangerous Khodorkovsky is, and he's short of a murderer, or maybe is, and therefore and a thief, and so he has to be kept in jail. But on the other hand, Putin is really trying to clean up his image for the Sochi Olympics that are coming up in a month or so, and he is trying to present himself as somebody where rights, human rights, are not frustrated, and he does appreciate the benevolent gestures. I mean, of course, the problem with this kind of approach is that it doesn't really make Putin look civilized, but much more of a tradition of first Russian Empire, then Soviet Empire, and now Putin. So I don't think it's that surprising. What is interesting is going to come after that. I mean, what kind of life Khodorkovsky can expect with this kind of Kremlin pardon and high level pardon? Is he going to be a public figure? Will he allow to be a public figure? Would he be forced to immigrate to, say, America or England? I mean, that is a very important question.
So, when Putin is under threat, he is petulant, petty, and vindictive. But he's now behaving in a magnanimous way. He's cut the sentences and freed two of the Pussy Riot women. He seems to be confident in terms of his foreign policy. He seemed to beat out the West in this diplomatic duel over Syria. He's just this week, he got Ukraine out of the deal with the EU, and now he's bought that corrupt government with an economic bailout. And then, of course, he's pushing this idea of his own Eurasian Union with Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, and now Ukraine. So Is this a case of him being confident enough to be magnanimous?
Well, yes, to a degree he is quite magnanimous, because he does take this these instances, and you know, this he shouldn't, but he does. He shouldn't take it as a sign of trust that all these things happen. It's just, you know, certain countries found themselves in dire straits, and so they had to go and use Putin, who was conveniently offering his services. But he does misconstrue it as his, you know, grown influence around the world, and something that he's been arguing for 14 years now, that Russia is a world player. It can dictate the fates of the world on the par with the United States. You mentioned the press conference. I mean, it was interesting that he has been sort of the various talking points of Putin floating around, and he in fact said, well, about the NSA spying and Edward Snowden, he said, well, lucky Barack Obama, he can do things like that, he can spy and there's no consequences. So Putin feels that he's very vindicated, not so much for the efforts of Russia, but for various conditions that various countries in the world found themselves in today. So one would say he's a very lucky leader, because things work out for him somehow. But I wouldn't really, you know, I wouldn't go with Putin to say that this is, that he can rest on his laurels, because the world is changing all the time, and Russia is not, and Putin's Russia is not. And therefore, I don't really envision that this so-called victories, opportunistic victories for Putin, actually can last a long time. Usually this kind of victories are very tactical, they're not strategic in any way, and the time passes and, you know, Putin remains. So I wouldn't, if I were Putin, I wouldn't be taking such a grandstanding. Actually, I would keep working on the improvement of Russia's standing rather than taking advantage of poor other countries' standing.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor of in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, let's face it, though. It seems to me that Putin doesn't really have any real plans to advance Russia. He seems to be more obsessed with trying to diminish the United States, and he's basically eradicated all political opposition and essentially completely neutralized the political life of Russia. Is there a political life left in Russia?
Well, you are completely right that he doesn't. I mean, that's exactly what I was saying, is that Putin has very little place to go, because all these things about what not Russia is, but what Russia, how Russia can stick it to other countries. So that is a very good assessment. As for political life, actually, there is a political life. I mean, you know, Russia has experienced the rise of political life in the last couple of years, when first Putin announced that he's going to become president again, which is, would be his third term and 13th year in power. That's first of all. So the opposition got energized, and there were protest movement. I mean, nothing comparing to Ukraine, of course, but still rather large protests against Putin and Putinism that have been going on. So I actually wouldn't say that, I mean, he wants to diminish the political life, but that's the problem, is that the longer he stays, actually the more political life, in fact, Russia will have, because at this point, it is so clear that there is no positive, anything positive that Putin can bring to either political life or economic life or any life in Russia whatsoever.
Well, it is, of course, a resource-based economy, and mostly on oil and gas, and with fracking and other improvements in oil production in the West, the U.S. is rapidly becoming self-sufficient and has surpassed Russia as the world's number one supplier of gas. A part of this bribe to keep Ukraine in the Russian fold has been this $18 billion loan, and plus a discount on Russian gas. What's your sense, though, of how long this oil and gas-based economy is going to last?
Well, that's, I mean, that is exactly the point, how long it's going to last, because Russia is not, that's what I was saying, it's the sort of oldest achievements are tactical, they are not modern in any way. It is a military-industrial complex that is being continuously built, and the world is moving forward, not, I mean, with bouts and setbacks, but still the world is moving forward. And so that is a good question, how long it's going to last. And so far, as I said, Putin has been very lucky. The world has presented him with all these opportunities, but it doesn't stay this way. And the longer he's in power, the harder the world works to move away from oil dependency or military dependency, or even diminish Russia's influence that Putin seems to be riding high at this point. So this is really a very closet way of dealing. I mean, he may think he's riding high on foreign policy, but it's a very closeted approach. It's all about Russia first, and you really, in the 21st century, this is also a very limited approach, because countries like Russia, of 9 time zones, you know, from Germany to Japan, they're very difficult to sustain in a viable or reliable manner. This is not China. This is not the United States. Russia really cannot sustain its size in modern economic environment.
So, Nina Khrushcheva, just going back to the press conference on Thursday, where Putin held forth for, I think, his usual 3 or 4 hours, and at the end of it, he basically, off the cuff, he just said that, by the way, we're going to free Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who spent more than 10 years in prison. That's serious enough punishment, he said. And meanwhile, of course, in this press conference, there was the usual displays of sycophancy from the almost entirely government-controlled press. One of the reporters offered him a little stuffed animal. It's pretty embarrassing as a journalist to watch this kind of stuff. But he's also shut down the Russian news service, has he not, and replaced that essentially with his own public relations operation?
Well, he didn't really shut down the Russian news service. He just changed the direction of it, so to speak. He renamed it from the news service. It's going to be Russia Today or Russia something or other of this kind, and it's going to, he sort of announced that it's going to stand for conservative Russian values and family traditions. So he has been making this argument that he is the center of original Christianity, which once again is such an old argument for the Russian Empire, in fact, because it was always arguing against the decadent West and how Orthodox Christianity stands for traditional and conservative values. And so once again, tactically, it may work for some places that are more conservative than modern European countries. But strategically, once again, where is he going to go with this? This is not a Byzantine Empire anymore. We're in 2013. And so he, in some ways, he thinks he's consolidating Russia and consolidating Russian influence. But more than anything, he's shooting himself in the foot, because it is such an unmodern approach that he proposes, and also incredibly hypocritical, because the man who is going to be in charge of this new Russia Today conservative values news creating set of values, as this man said, has been divorced. Putin himself was very famously divorced last summer. So that is kind of rich coming out of this man, that they are going to promote Christian conservative values. Russia has no place to go unless it reforms itself, restructures itself, loses territory, and rethinks its military-industrial complex altogether.
Well, would that explain then this anti-gay jihad, these two good Christian family men that you just mentioned? I mean, we have here in the United States this hideous homophobic outburst from the Duck Dynasty character, those people all couch themselves in religiosity, and at the same time they, you know, are dripping with bigotry. It would seem to me that, as far as I can tell from Putin's anti-gay jihad, it's popular in Russia, And he's trying to have it both ways with Sochi, saying, you know, that gay athletes aren't going to be persecuted. But Obama has appointed an openly gay head of the U.S. Olympic delegation. So what's your sense of how will there be, do you think, any kind of protests both for and against Putin's homophobia in Sochi?
Well, I'm sure there will be protests, and I would not go as far as, I hate disagreeing with you, but I wouldn't go as far as saying it's anti-gay jihad, because if you look at this law carefully, the way the law is presented, I mean, we can argue how genuine it is, but the way the law is presented, it's against gay propaganda towards the minors, so it's not exactly go and beat up gays. Of course, Russians may understand it this way and do understand it this way in some ways. But Putin himself would argue that that's not what he is looking into. It he's just sort of promoting gay pedophilia and gay way of life to the minors. So he would say that there is no jihad there, and I think we should be careful with this kind of words. This is one thing, but another thing I mean, good for Barack Obama not going, good for many leaders in Europe not going, and Putin shouldn't have expected. It was a good lesson for him because, you know, if he wanted that kind of law be introduced, do it up to the Olympics. I mean, if Russia wants that law introduced. He decided he can do it all. He couldn't do it all. So that's a good lesson for him. As for protests, I'm sure they will happen. I think Putin will be very careful not to beat up the protesters or treat them in any inhumane way, at least while the foreigners are there watching. What happens afterwards, that we'll have to see. How that is going to play out, we'll have to see. But I don't think that Putin can afford, and it seems that he understands it a bit more now, is that he cannot really afford a blatant anti-Western or blatant anti-gay kind of pronouncements against gay propaganda towards minors. And I think that's why he's toning down his conversations about it. I mean, just recently he said, well, he's no problem with any athletes who come to Sochi and whatnot. So I think he slightly understands, I don't know how much he understands because he thinks he's such an emperor, but slightly understands he probably went a bit too far with this kind of law. Not that this law is not going to come back in full force right after the Olympics is over.
Well, one of the aspects of that law, though, I understand, and it's true, it's couched in the idea that somehow gays run around recruiting vulnerable young men and boys, and this has to be stopped. But I understand there's a vigilante component to the law, that people are allowed to take the law into their own hands to stop this perceived activity.
Well, that is, I mean, and that is sort of a problem. So because Putin knows his own country, and even that such an ambiguous law, of course, in the hands of Russians who are homophobic and macho thinking and whatnot, can be taken very, very far. But that's generally a problem with any Russian law, is when, you know, the police is told to keep paradox, to keep the order, then the police goes too far. When the guards are told to guard something, they go too far. I mean, and that is kind of a problem. It's just generally a problem with a country that has no laws and always looks for order. So that is sort of a general problem that Russia experiences, is that law is prone to interpretation. Order is not. Order is just one way that everybody is kept in line. And that's where the greatest problem is.
Well, just in the last minute, Nina Khrushcheva, back to the freeing of the oil tycoon, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was in fact perceived by Putin as his main political rival, and he's neutralized him by putting him away in jail for 11 years. They were even moving to increase charges against him, and this caused the liberal economist Sergei Guriev to flee Russia for Paris. So Is there any possibility? You were suggesting earlier that perhaps Khodorkovsky will probably leave the country. In other words, there's no he doesn't have a political future there, does he?
Well, I actually that I what I was saying is that it would be really interesting to see what kind of future he has, because I imagine he envisions his political future, because he would join the protests and with his name and his credentials of, you know, being in Gulag, in contemporary Russian Gulag for 11 years, he would be a very attractive opposition figure. The question is how free he's going to continue with that. I mean, wouldn't, you know, if he goes and has some sort of an opposition movement, would he be arrested immediately now for inciting violence against Putin? That is a really important question. The important question is to see how far Khodorkovsky will be allowed to go in his political future, his economic future, his any future. So it is possible that he will choose to leave the country and perhaps run some opposition movement from the outside, because I'm not sure he would have enough freedom to do it inside the country. And the question is how willing he will be to go back to prison this time for, say, I don't know, as I said, inciting violence against
sure.
Putin, or whatever Putin decides to charge him with.
Sure, and of course he's lost most of his money. It's been confiscated. His companies have been confiscated and handed over to Putin's cronies, so he wouldn't have not just his political horizons are limited, his economic horizons have also been limited. I thank you for joining us, Nina Kosheva. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She is also an editor and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia, Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the likelihood of a civil war now in South Sudan.